Welcome to the Prison Mindfulness Podcast, presented by the Prison Mindfulness Institute. In this podcast, we'll be talking with experts in the fields of prison mindfulness and prison dharma, discussing their transformative work in prisons and jails.
So welcome, everyone. This is Vita Pierdes here for the Prison Mindfulness Institute. I'm happy to be here with Chatti. Is that right?
Chatti.
Chatti has been working with the Lineage Project since 2009. As a senior teacher, she shares embodied awareness practices with youth in detention centers, incarceration programs, and public high schools. Chatti leads trainings and professional development workshops, which promotes mindfulness through a trauma-conscious, social justice, and resilience-building lens. She also develops curriculum and mentors new teachers. Outside of her work with Lineage, Chatti leads international yoga retreats and provides wellness justice consulting through her business, One Love Wellness. She is on faculty with the Garrison Institute's Contemplative-Based Resilience Project, which supports the sustainability of humanitarian aid workers, social service providers, and congregational staff. She believes in making wellness accessible, affordable, and relevant for all. Welcome, Chatti.
Thanks so much, Vita. Thank you so much.
You've been teaching for quite a while and running Lineage Projects. So what got you into this work? What was your inspiration?
Well, I first started teaching yoga about 19 years ago. And when I first started teaching, I was teaching in public high schools. And then I also taught in foster care. And so it was kind of a natural progression for me, thinking, what other populations of young people do I want to teach? And so I wanted to teach young people in detention. And so I kind of did a little bit of research and found the Lineage Project. I went through their training, became a volunteer, and I was volunteering at Crossroads, which is a detention center in the Bronx that is now closed. And from being a volunteer with Lineage, I became a teacher and have been a teacher with Lineage for the last 13 years.
So how long has the Lineage Project been around, and how did it evolve as an organization from its beginnings?
Yeah, the Lineage Project has been around for over 20 years. It was started in 1999, and it kind of evolved even in the practices that it offered. I believe it started off teaching meditation to young people in detention, and then yoga was added in. And so now we say we offer mindfulness practices, a combination of mindful movement and meditation. And in the 13 years that I've been with Lineage, I feel like it's also evolved not only in the practices that we offer, but also its centering of anti-racism and anti-oppression. When I first started, it was mostly just, these are the practices that we offer. And I think I really want to lift up our co-executive directors, Jessica Mingus and Gabrielle Prisco, really centering anti-oppression and anti-racism as part of our core values. We work with mostly brown and black youth. So to not talk about systems of oppression and to talk about racism and the impact on young people we serve would be a disservice. And so I think because we've been around for 20 plus years, having that accountability and really thinking about kind of how is the best that we serve is really important. There was a tagline, this is before I became a teacher of Lineage, that was like, we go in to keep them out. And that was like really cringy for me. You know, it's very much like a white savior nonprofit kind of way of thinking about it and really kind of moving away from that to centering youth needs and youth voices and youth resources and their voices and knowledge and wisdom. It has been a really beautiful thing for me to witness being a teacher with Lineage.
So it's important that facilitators unpack their own privilege and, you know, biases and blind spots in relationship to the work. And so do you train your facilitators in extensive work on that?
Yeah, so we do a lot of internal work at Lineage. We have offer our teachers different types of professional development. Last year, we as an organization participated in a 9-month program called Communal Consultations with Resma Menachem, who is a trauma therapist and also a somatic abolitionist, talking about healing racialized trauma through the body, through somatics. And in that work, we were able to also, as an organization, talk about these very things of privilege and oppression and unconscious and conscious biases and how they might show up in our work. And it's super important. We also lead trainings that are for the general public, like our 21-hour trainings, and for people interested in teaching mindfulness practices to young people or other people. And I remember, you know, one of the a woman asked, one of the participants, she's a white woman, and she's like, well, can I do this work? Being a white woman, can I do this work? And I very gently asked back to her, can you? Because that's when we really kind of pause and lean in and unpack that. I'm an Asian American woman. I identify as a person of color. I also know I won't be stopped and frisked on the street, perhaps like another person of color, a Black male, for example. And so really being able to understand your social location and your identity, and also kind of the ways mindfulness practices too can also sometimes be kind of colonized, and then unpacking that, I think all of that is relevant and important in this work.
So I like what you wrote here in the email you sent to Melissa. It said, embodying a trauma-conscious mind and resilience-based methodology is a framework that shifts away from the deficit-based approach of what's wrong with you to a resource-based mindset, what can support you. Right. So can you talk a little bit about how your classes might reflect that sort of mindset and framework?
Yeah, so what we offer is mindfulness practices through a social justice and trauma-informed lens. And kind of those are all kind of buzzwords these days, you know, yeah. Mindfulness, trauma-informed lens, all of that. But really thinking about kind of contextualizing any practices that we offer to young people with an understanding of how trauma has impacted us, not only as individuals, but also collectively, especially people who are directly impacted by systems of oppression. And I think when we can move away from kind of this idea of like what's wrong with you to how can we support you? What we're doing is we're leaning on to strengths building and resiliency building. And that's super important. I mean, it's one thing to teach a breathing technique as a mindfulness practice. It's another thing to mirror back to a young person that they already have strengths and they have the resilience in them. Because young people, especially young people who are incarcerated, hear all the time, there's something wrong with you.
Right.
And so really being able, and we internalize that. We internalize that message of there is something wrong with me and I'm defective and I'm not good enough. And then perhaps then that turns out as behavior, and young people can act out, or we as people can act out. And so when we can mirror back and reflect strengths instead of deficits, it can help any of us towards feeling less broken and more with a sense of belonging.
Yeah, I was working in one facility and I noticed that, well, it was kind of blatant. The staff all referred to the young men as scumbags, and they would say this word scumbags over and over and over. And they would yell, okay, scumbag one, get over there. Scumbag number so-and-so, get over there. And I was kind of like, it was the overkill of this word. It was kind of crazy, the use of the word scumbag. So how, for example, would you, you know, then the kids get in there and they've been called this, it's almost like conditioning their minds over and over and over again, that this is the way the whole world views them. How would you work with countering that? You know, because in these young minds that are getting, this is what they're learning. This is what people think of them.
Absolutely.
And label them. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's such a great question, because it's true. We internalize those messages. I mean, I'm thinking about a class I taught in a detention center, and the young man was like, oh, well, I'm always angry. You know, I'm told I'm angry. I know I'm angry. I'm always angry. And he had been in my class maybe two or three times, so not many times. And I said to him, that's really interesting, because in the times I've known you, in the 3 hours of the three classes we spent together, I didn't get that impression at all. You weren't angry once in my class. And he just kind of paused and was like, oh, wait, oh, there was times I'm not angry, because it can become a generalized blanketed identity. And right. So in our classes, what we try to offer and what I try to offer just in general is calling up strengths. So in addition to teaching mindfulness practices, being like, oh, you know, like I saw that you persevered through that twist in that yoga pose, you know, how did they feel for your body? And really being able to name up strengths is a tool of resilience building. And for when we feel resilient in the body, we feel like we have the potential to thrive, to flourish. And a lot of our young people or people who have experienced trauma, they're just in survival mode. When you're being called a scumbag over and over again, when you just feel like you're angry and reactive all the time, you are in survival mode in your brain and your nervous system. So our classes perhaps can offer a chance to ground and settle and not be so hypervigilant. And then also for young people to access their humanity, for young people to access what it's like to lean into their identity that's not what someone else has labeled them as.
Yeah, and also to be heard. Sometimes I noticed there was a lot of mumbling going on in classes, you know, that I was teaching. And then I said, what's up with the mumbling? And they said, well, everybody says that to us. And I said, but why do you think that is? And he said, well, one guy said, well, nobody really wants to hear us, you know. And I go, yeah, I want to hear you.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, really? Yeah. And then it kind of opened up the space, and then they all felt like, yeah, your voice is important. It's important to hear what you have, what's inside of you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that whatever they're going through and is valid, you know, yeah. I think there is also a culture of shame and blame just in general. And for example, in one of my classes, we were talking about what helps you cope with stress. And a couple of young people said, I smoke weed. And the juvenile counselor was like, don't say that. Why do you do that? You shouldn't do that. And it's like, well, if I live in a neighborhood where, you know, that's what's available to me, and actually what a blessing it is that I want to actually try to get to a place of calm and settling in my nervous system so I know to reach for a resource. Now, maybe marijuana, is, you know, there's a debate whether or not that should be the resource, but the young person is reaching for a resource. So instead of shaming and blaming their actions or the thing they do, really leaning into, okay, your body wants to be resourced. So let's talk about that. And a mindfulness practice can help that, perhaps. Meditation can help that, perhaps. But I also don't walk in there thinking mindfulness practices are the thing that's going to like cure systemic oppression and make you feel good for the rest of your life. No, it's just a technique that perhaps can be useful and helpful. And more so, that hour we spend together, can it be an hour of connection? Can it be an hour where, again, you don't have to feel hypervigilant? Can it be a time where you feel heard? You know, Maya Angelou has this quote, people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And so in the Lineage Project, in our classes, we want young people to feel a sense of trust in themselves and within class, and to feel validated, to feel heard, and to feel empowered in their bodies. Oh, I can do this with my body and it feels a certain way. Oh, I can make this choice for myself. And so really kind of countering all the mumbling, like you were saying, or all the kind of other people's ideas of who they are, so that they can start to kind of really understand like, what works for me? What's good for me? And what's beneficial for me?
I had a class where, you know, these guys, they're very funny. You know, they're kind of funny and they like to talk about their funny stories. And they got into this rant with each other about like, oh, so-and-so, did you hear this person got shot? And then they were all like, I've been shot. And then they're all going back and forth about how many times have you been shot, and pulling up their shirts and showing their wounds and all this kind of stuff. And then one guy started yelling, these guys are making all this up. None of them have been shot. You know, it was kind of like, it's like a vying for who's been shot the most times. And these were like 15 and 16 and 14 year old boys. And they're, how many times have they been shot? And it was kind of like, kind of breathtaking, actually, you know, to see that this is their reality and this is their badge of honor, you know, in a way that they need to feel some kind of camaraderie or empathy, like group empathy with each other around this wound, this severe wounding, you know, to their bodies. Mm. So, kind of this profound moment. And the only way they had to do it was to, you know, see which one had been shot the most times. You know, that was the toughest guy in the room, right?
Yeah. And I think there is, you know, this kind of idea, especially with young men, and this is given by society and by different cultures, like of masculinity. And that's why sometimes it's difficult to get buy-in to do mindfulness practices. You know, like, oh, yoga is gay. Oh, it's only for girls. Oh, mindfulness is soft, you know? And so I think that we want to meet young people where they are and not discount their lived experience and what they've been through, both the trauma and the resilience of what they've been through, and then to be able to connect. Because what I'm hearing from what you shared, the story you shared, is connection. The young men are showing each other their scars, but they're really looking for connection. And mm-hmm. so we have basic human needs of safety, connection, and satisfaction. And so however we can find those things through whatever channels, it's important to kind of meet young people where they are. And sometimes when I see a young person's behavior, especially if a young person's kind of wilding out, I'll often think about, oh, what's the need behind that behavior? Because there's a need for safety, a need for connection, a need for feeling a sense of satisfaction, like purposefulness, meaningfulness. And when we can kind of look at behavior through that lens, it also takes us from what's wrong with you to what's working for you and how can we support you. And in detention centers, it is divided not by gender, but by biological sex. So, Yeah. You know, so it's like cisgender male and cisgender female. Yeah. And like there's a whole thing because there's some trans kids who are in prison, right? So it itself can be really traumatizing. Our lineage model is a three-part model. So we teach, we have guided discussion based on a theme, mindful movement, and meditation. And sometimes a group is more chatty. And girls maybe tend to want to share a little bit more off the jump, meaning kind of the first class, versus maybe for the young men, it takes a little while, like a little bit more trust building for them to share a little bit more vulnerably and openly. Sometimes the young men like to do a little bit more of a vigorous movement practice. So we'll do like more arm balances, for example, or anything like that. And I've seen no matter what gender you are, though, I think that there's some aspect of the class that perhaps can be of interest to you. So having a moment of introspection during meditation, having a moment where you connect to a stretch in the body, having a moment where there is a connection over the theme, where maybe we're talking about the difference between pain and suffering, and talking about what is it, what's the difference between being reactive or being responsive? How do you find support? What do you think, what are some strengths that you have, mental and physical? And so I think that there are differences, and I think that it could be somewhat biological. It can also be societal and cultural differences. But I also think about leaning into the commonality, because I think that's what creates a sense of community, is a sense of shared experience and shared humanity. And so when we kind of set up our classes in that way, we can access those things, hopefully.
So what about working in public high schools? How is that different from working in institutional setting? I mean, that's another form of institution, but it's a little bit, you know, kids get to go out after they at the end of the day. So what are the differences there?
Yeah.
The challenges
I think... For me, it doesn't really have so much to do with the setting. You know, young people are young people. I love working with teenagers. They are, like you said, super funny. I learn so much from them. I'm inspired by them. I'm inspired by their resilience. And whether it's teaching online or in person in these different facilities, I think kind of connecting to, again, those basic human needs of connection, satisfaction, and safety. And when we can set up the conditions for those three, magic can happen in classes. I think perhaps, though, the difference I feel in working with young people, again, this is not site dependent, but really about kind of, are they signed up to do it? So are they kind of forced to participate versus do they choose to participate? And sometimes working with young people in detention, they're kind of encountering a situation where they maybe have thought they were going to be in. Like a couple of young people I talked to were like, I knew I was going to be locked up. But kind of thinking about it, imagining it and being in it is two different things. And when you're 15 and like wanna like, you know, get your like, your sex hormones are raging, you're like, I do not want to be locked up. And so sometimes you're kind of like, what's going to help me get out? And so I've seen in some young people an openness and a receptivity to the practices because they want to find different resources to help them help themselves make different choices. So whether that's in detention or in public schools where there's this like relentless focus on doing well on tests, and young people are just feeling so much pressure to do well in school and being competitive with other people and having to go to every single after school program, and then or feeling like you're struggling and not being able to reach out for support on basic things like reading and writing and literacy and math. All those things add a lot of stress and overwhelm to the nervous system. And so sometimes young people come to our classes and they're like, oh, wow, these are great resources because I can actually feel myself breathing because I feel like I've held my breath for this long, like trying to get through my day at school or trying to get through, you know, my sentence or whatever that is.
Yeah. Wow. So thinking about the name of your project, the Lineage Project, do you do anything around lineage, like in teaching about, you know, like connecting with the lineage of people, however, your people or your culture or lineages, you know, do you work with that at all, that idea?
I'm smiling because that's like kind of the tennis ball that's served back and forth in our team meetings, you know, because we all inherited this name, Lineage Project, and we're actually not even sure kind of the thinking behind it, to be honest, you know, but it's sort of like the lineage of these practices that come actually from Buddhist and East Asian wisdoms that I think sometimes gets filtered, especially if we're teaching in DOE schools, they want it to be very secular. And then all, but really honoring those lineages because that's where these mindfulness practices have come from. And then our own personal lineages, like the way where each teacher has studied. Like I did my yoga training in India and have a very deep reverence and gratefulness for that those lineages that I study through. And then also thinking about with the young people their own personal lineages and their you know and kind of thinking about like when we talk about mindfulness practices, do young people already have embodied awareness? It doesn't have to be Qigong. It doesn't have to be meditation. But they have some sort of resourcing practices. We're curious to hear what those are so that we can build kind of like our lineage together. And then kind of thinking about this idea of lineage, kind of like what passes through us to our descendants, whoever those descendants may be. And so with a Lineage Project where we are creating and having planting the seeds to create is a branch of our organization where we have students who were formerly in our programs becoming teachers with Lineage so that they can teach with us. And so really being able to have young people who were formerly incarcerated or credible messengers it'd be wonderful. We don't have any teachers who have that lived experience. And I think that would be such a wonderful, enriching experience for everyone involved in our lineage.
Beautiful. So as you're talking about credible messengers and how would you, you know, one of the things that you wanted to talk about was as a longtime teacher and trainer, what do you think of some of the core competencies for skillfully holding these practices? So say you were going to train a formerly incarcerated person or someone who's been, you know, whatever, you know, in any kind of situation that would give them the credible messenger status or, you know, whatever, but they could embody that or they are embodying that. What are the core competencies they need to work on and develop in order to be able to hold the space?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. I think first and foremost, having some sort of practice yourself as a facilitator. I meditate every morning. I have a yoga and qigong practice. I also like to take breaks and go into nature And I have a Lineage colleague that I call specific. He's a friend of mine as well, but I call him specifically about Lineage classes because he's worked in detention centers as well. So he has an understanding of kind of that setting and those needs. And so being able to have the resourcing with for yourself so that you can show up fresh and curious and open to classes. I was teaching in this, it's called an ALC, Alternate Learning Center. It's in public schools. If you're suspended from your regular high school, you are placed in these alternate learning centers. And so it was a middle school and it was tough. It was a 12-week residency and, oh, I had to pull every trick and game and tool and strategy out of all my pockets. The young people were not having it. They did not want to participate in class. The teachers and staff were burnt out. Like we had kids literally leaning halfway out the window and just trying to coax them back inside. And I felt myself, you know, like heat rising into my face, like my heart beating fast. And this was at the boys club on the Lower East Side. And there was a plant store two blocks away. And so I made it a point. It was like a ritual after class to walk to the plant store and just walk through the store, touching leaves, listening to this calming music. You know, the store clerk saw me week after week, was like, are you going to buy anything? And I'm like, no, I'm just being here with the plants, you know, and because it gave me a chance to kind of release kind of the energy that I was holding from that class so I can go back the next week. Open and curious and not with kind of this, you know, because you can go in very closed and very judgmental. And so I think having practices as a facilitator is so important so that you can stay alive and present to the work with authenticity and to show up in the best way for the young people. And then to also continue to unpack the privileges and the blind spots and the biases that we may have. And I think also what's really, really important is to not reduce the young people to the experiences that they had or the traumas that they had. Recognizing that we all live in a system of oppression, but Black and Brown youth are 5 times more likely to be suspended from school, to be arrested, to be sentenced than their white counterparts. So just kind of knowing that and holding that in your mind as a facilitator can be really helpful in terms of how you relate to the young people. And I think also it takes some of the onus of responsibility off the young people. And I think one of my biggest struggles is like, I go in to teach young people mindfulness practices, but is it really making a difference? Because these systems are designed to continue to oppress them. So it's a lot to ask a young person to get it together, get control over your anger, get control over your impulses, to not act out when they are living in systems that are designed to be threatening to their well-being and their safety. And so really being able to hold all of that while you're teaching class and really being able to call up the strengths and humanity of each young person is kind of a life learning. And I'm still learning after so many years of teaching, like how to be the most efficient in doing that. Because that's the kind of facilitator I want to be.
Yeah, that's great. As you were describing what you do to resource yourself afterwards, you know, where you walk through the plant store or, you know, you can, I don't know, there's various things you could do, look in the sky or whatever you do. We're actually in our program, one of our programs, a couple of our programs in a couple different states, we're training the inmates, the folks who are in prison to be the facilitators. Mm-hmm. They don't have any kind of place like that to go to refresh their minds. So I just as you were saying that, I thought, I wonder if we could have a conversation with them, like, what do you do to refresh your mind in that way? You know, I mean, go out to the yard, but even there, that could be not exactly refreshing. So what would you do? You know, so I think that's an interesting, because they seem to have a lot of resilience. So where does it come from? When you don't seem to have a lot of options and you're being, you know, institutionalized, you know, it's just, that would be an interesting inquiry that I'd like to have with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that's why I appreciate that part of our model when we have time for guided for discussion, because it's you hear a lot about, that's how I learn about different ways of resourcing and resilience. One young man in a detention center said, when the lights go off at a certain time at night when they have to go to bed, he lies in bed and he'll think about his favorite place to be. And that's his meditation. And I'm like, that is a beautiful meditation. Right? Meditation doesn't have to look like sitting cross-legged. I know I'm breathing in. I know I'm breathing out. That is a beautiful practice. But also playing basketball, working up a sweat, and busting chops with the other young men, that is also another type of resilience and resourcing practice. So it's definitely something we've thought about in Lineage, right? It's like, okay, we offer mindfulness practices. We're starting to now incorporate more somatic practices in the techniques that we offer. And then it's like, yeah. We need to ask the young people what they do. It's like, ooh, how radical is that? You know, like the people that we serve. Yes, let's ask them what they already do. And so that shifts it away from, oh, we know these practices could work. Because yes, I know for myself personally, these practices work. We don't know how it's going to land for someone else. And so we have something called a community cohort program where we take young people through this 10-12 week program. And from there, perhaps a couple of them will apprentice with us to potentially become teachers. And so through that program, we want to design a student handbook, a handbook of different mindfulness practices written by and for youth. So sure, perhaps there's meditation in there, but let's see what else shows up in there. And I'm so curious to know. And a lot of young people, you know, they journal. They make TikTok videos and their TikTok video is a meditative process, you know, and so not to discount kind of the ways that each of us can resource. And I think we can then broaden this idea of what embodied awareness practice is.
Yeah. There's a lot of, as you were saying that, I thought of all the way, you know, reading book or, you know, drawing, paint, you know, some can do painting, some can do poetry, you know, writing, all kinds of things. Writing letters to people, you know, we get a lot of lots of letters. Mm-hmm. So what's the most challenging thing that you have encountered?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier the kind of challenge of, teaching mindfulness practices within systems of oppression. So I already mentioned that one. The second challenge is that a lot of our programs are residency-based, meaning 10 weeks, 12 weeks, maybe a year. I was at a state-run facility called Ella McQueen in Bushwick, and they got funding and for 5.5 years, consistently through the years I was there. It was amazing. But the young people themselves were only there for 2 weeks. So it was a processing center. So they were being processed for all different types of information and health checks and stuff before they were sent to serve time upstate. And so maybe I would have one touch or four classes with the young people before they left. And so it's kind of like, is anything landing, you know, within, and so that's why we have our three-part model. It's like, here it is in one chunk. Even if you encounter our program for one class, you get kind of the heart of what we offer. And I remember doing a resilience training and I had gone up to the facilitator after, and I was kind of explaining, I was at that time, this was maybe 6 years ago, I was feeling a little like close to feeling a little burnt out, like, cause I wasn't sure I was like making a difference. And I'm really grateful for not only this facilitator, Maria Siros, but also my training in positive psychology in general, because she said to me, oh, call up their strengths. Find one thing in each young person and call up their strength. Because they might not remember the breathing technique or the yoga pose, but they'll remember like the person saying to them, I saw how courageous you were in trying something new. I saw your humor in falling down from that balance pose and getting back up. And so really that became kind of the thing that I do, not only in my classes with lineage, but in my life. You can ask my partner, he would be like, yes, I can hear you calling up my strengths, you know? But I think that's so important because don't we all want to feel that, like feel our strengths mirrored to us? And then that helped give me resilience to keep doing the work, because in resilience theory, they talk about, you know, caring competent adults or caring competent people in your lives is a protective factor. So you have these skills to build up resilience in yourself and then also through authentic connection. And so I think that made me shift and see that the transitory nature of our work isn't so much a challenge anymore for me. And I think also the reframe of behavior, it takes it from challenge to curiosity for me. So as a teaching artist, when I was doing trainings, they were all like about classroom management, right? So how to manage your classroom, how to manage different behaviors, you know, the kid that has the hoodie up that doesn't want to participate to the one that's like, you know, distracting others. And so it was very much kind of almost, it was punitive. And I think education in the United States has that punitive lens. They want everyone like from kindergarten sitting like hands folded, legs crossed kind of thing. And so I think, especially with young people who experience trauma or who have been taken out of their home situation, they can be feeling abandoned or dropped or like not good enough and for whatever way. And so sometimes you start to act out because negative attention is still a type of attention. And so for me, I've learned to see, what's the need behind that behavior versus focusing on the behavior. And so when I do that, I don't actually see classroom management as a challenge anymore. So I feel like if I can reframe in my brain, challenges become curiosities.
So being able to just look into the heart of what's going on, the essence of what, rather than the necessary manifestation or whatever they're, you know, saying or doing, that it, you can see it underneath the heart of it. There's something that's really being expressed, you know, that they would wish for, or hope for, or value in their lives. Yeah.
Yeah. If I could tell a story, I was teaching at a close to home facility. So this is a locked, secure facility, but it's a residential home in Flatbush. In Brooklyn. And it was my first time. It was a new group of young men. And one of them didn't want to participate. And I don't force anyone to participate. Sometimes they are forced by their juvenile counselors to participate, but I don't force. And so I said, you know, you can just watch if you want to. He couldn't leave because he had to stay in the room with everyone else. So I just kind of saw him like, you know, sitting there. And like once in a while, like, you know, I want to join. And he's like, no, I'm good. And he wasn't distracting any of the other young men, you know? So I was like, okay, you know, do your thing over there, you know? But he was just kind of like giving me side eye and kind of like making little comments, like when I would say stuff and I'd be like, okay. And I'd be like, no, I was like, do you want to participate? Instead of being like, be quiet. I was like, do you want to participate? And he's like, no. And you know, and then we moved on from the discussion. We're doing movement, we're doing neck rotations, and I think he unconsciously started to do a neck rotation and caught himself and was like, oh, I'm not doing that, you know, stood, like sat there with his arms folded for the rest of class, you know. And I just, you know, again, just invited him in a few times, didn't react to when he refused. He wasn't impolite in any way. Again, he wasn't distracting anyone else. And then at the end of class, I have a, you know, I try to greet everyone as I come in and then have a moment with everyone one-on-one. At the end of class, this is when, like, you know, I'll call up strengths or make an observation about what I saw in class. And so I went up to him and I said, you know, like, I noticed that, you know, like, even though you didn't participate, I felt like you were part of the group. I really felt that you were like holding space for everyone else. And, you know, like you didn't distract anyone. I really want to, I appreciate your attention. He was kind of like, oh, whatever, miss, you know? And then the next week he did one small part of class. And by the end of the program, he was fully participating and also encouraging other young men to participate. And we talked about it. And he was like, well, I just didn't know what it was. And I was like, yeah, of course. when something is new, it can be very anxiety provoking. You know, it's like, oh, wait, yay, yoga. It's like, no, like, what is this new thing? You know what I mean? Like, why, who's this new person telling me to breathe? Like, so, you know, and so because I didn't judge him, I didn't shame him. I didn't say, well, if you were not participating, like, leave, you know, or like, you know, don't, you know, be in the circle in any way. You know, you want to be able to meet people where they are. And that's why I love teaching young people. Young people keep it real. They will tell you if they like something or not. They will tell you if they like you or not, you know? And so, yeah, you know? And so for me, it's like, I find that so refreshing. And I'm like, okay, how do I meet people where they are? And that's what working with young people has taught me for sure.
Yeah, I love that. I love that calling up the strengths that you keep saying too. You know, like I once did a motivational interviewing and the guy leading it said, when everything, you can't think of anything else, affirm, just affirm. You can never affirm enough. Just keep on affirming. See something to affirm and affirm it, you know. But calling up the strengths, it really does, you know, kind of like get it for me for working with youth. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's really beautiful. So if you had just what really inspires you about the people, these kids, if you just had to say a sentence about, you know, like if I just said what so inspires me about these kids.
That's such a good question. There's a lot that inspires me. They're just, it, like I mentioned, their resilience really inspires me. Their humor, the way that they can have perspective on their lives, and sometimes like a theme we'll bring in is like, what's something you're grateful for? And sometimes they'll say life. That's it. Like they're not grateful to be locked up, you know, although some may be. Like I remember this young man said, actually, I am grateful because it stopped me from this. I think I would be dead if I didn't get locked up. So it can change, offer a change of trajectory or not. Right. I'm not, you know, like nothing is like it's all dependent on the young person. But I think whatever life experience they've gone through and whatever traumas perhaps they have gone through, that they're grateful for life. You know, they're grateful to still be living. They're grateful for the lessons learned. And I think that that's a beautiful message for all of us. For whatever challenge we go through, whatever obstacle we can go through, if we can look at the lessons learned, if we can grow from that experience, then we can feel that we still have hope and possibility. And I wish that for anyone. I think for young people who are incarcerated, often society tells them there is no hope and possibility for you anymore. And I appreciate you changing your language, you know, talking about inmates and people who are formerly incarcerated, you know, talk about felons versus people who are formerly incarcerated folks. Language matters. Mm-hmm. Because when you say, you know, I was at a party one time years ago and I was talking to someone I didn't know. And I was telling him I work with Lineage Project or work with teens in detention. And he said, oh, what's that like working with criminals? And I said, the day I start seeing my young people as criminals is the day I stop doing this work. And so really, it's about your perspective and being able to access hope and possibility, circling back to that. And so when you're saying you're labeling someone as a criminal, there's no hope and possibility. But aren't these mindfulness practices designed to transform? Aren't we all in life yearning to kind of grow and learn? And so I feel inspired by my young people because I see that in them. I see no matter what has happened to them, their humor, there is a type of hope. Their resilience is a type of possibility. And I'm so grateful to be able to bear witness to that and to also be inspired by them with that.
Well, I thank you so much for this. I'm very inspired by you and by your enthusiasm and your obviously heartfelt care that you have for these people, young people, you know, who are in such a tough situation, you know, and have their whole lives ahead of them possibly. And, you know, just what a way to spend your youth. I don't know, but I'm very inspired talking, hearing what you have to say and the way you teach and, you know, your whole project seems beautifully framed to include all the aspects that need to be there, the core.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm super grateful to Lineage Project and being a teacher with them for many years. I feel like it's developed me as a person and also a more competent teacher. So yeah, thank you so much for your feedback.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about PMI and our programs, please visit prisonmindfulness.org. You can also keep up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn.